Welcome to another episode of Trick Talkers, a podcast about trick takers, shedders, climbers, and as of recent times, we've firmly established that we do also talk about other card games occasionally. We are your hosts. I'm Patrick.
And I'm Ryan.
And today, we're going to be talking about the dreaded or the relieving culls. I can't even say it today. You'll have to keep this in the episode there, Ryan, just because I've butchered another pronunciation again. Recent culls of the collection. It's summertime, and that normally means one thing, a purge of the gaming collection, as the weather gets warmer and we spend more time outside and realize we've got far too many games.
Shedding off clothes and shedding off games at the same time?
There we do. Or you shedding off clothes while somebody puts a copy of Eggs of Ostrich in your bag? Or maybe I've got it mixed up.
Oh, no, I think that's an appropriate game to have at the same time.
There we go. Whatever floats your boat, as they say.
Of course.
So would you like to start us off, Ryan, and talk to me about some of the games that you've got rid of? Hopefully none of the games that I'm attached to.
I obviously, with our whole discussion of the challenge and trying to get unplayed games played, that is leading me to also trying to trim down my collection and leave the games that I'm really enjoying and wanting to play more often as the ones I'm keeping. And a majority of these ones that I've sold are actually ones that have been on my shelf for a while that I've already played, but I haven't played in like 5 or 6 months. Because we're not really sure how we're going to flow this yet, but I'm going to just list all of my games off sort of rapid fire motion. Yeah. And then Patrick can rapid fire his as well. And then we can look to see if there's any crossovers or maybe if there's others that weren't on the list that we're still thinking about or whatnot. So, my list is Iados, Sweets in Wonderland, American Bookshop, Cinderella's Dance, Cobras, Custom Heroes, Tower of Pancakes, Amino Kirafuda, also known as Heavenly Trump, Ebis, Salvage, which has been recently reprinted as St. Patrick, Loser's Rights, and Plotter's Ink, which is also known as Mitlist Untuk.
Before I quickfire my list too, tell me, have you got any games in there that you haven't played at all?
No, all of those I have played at least once.
Okay.
Cobras, Custom Heroes, and Loser's Rights are all the three that I've played once. Every others I've played multiple times.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious because you know how it is. They were sitting on the shelf for a while and curiosity got the better of me, Ryan. Well, my list is Amino Kirifuda. There'll be a groan from the audience now, obviously. We've both got rid of that game. Loser's Rights, Ghosts of Christmas, Shamans, Was Stick, in my best German, St. Patrick, otherwise known as Salvage, Bottle Imp, The Great Dalmutty. The Joker of the pack is a dismantled proxy of Zimbabwe Trick, which I've firmly dismantled, and Prophecy.
Okay, so my question for you then is, as you asked me of any unplayed games, are any of yours on that list unplayed?
There are, actually. So on the list of games that I haven't played include Shamans, St. Patrick, The Great Dalmutty. I feel like I had to say that with a bit of oomph because of just the name kind of requires it. And I also didn't play The Dismantled Proxy of Zimbabwe Trick, which I went to a lot of effort to put together.
Okay. So, and I think it's funny that you're including a proxy on the list because the game itself, like you didn't purchase Zimbabwe Trick itself, correct. You had a proxy, but you still had to buy a deck of something to proxy it with, which I'm assuming you used the Great Dalmutty deck, correct, for that?
Yes, because of the indexing on the cards, the Great Dalmutty works well. So if anybody would like to try Zimbabwe Trick out, apparently it works well. I can't speak to that, of course, because I dismantled it. And also, Ryan, I did get some of these lovely shiny silver cubes that we all love in the board gaming world. And I decided to take them out and use them with another game. I thought, well, great, Dalmatia's going. So there goes by default, whether you say it's a legitimate, you know, disposal or not, my copy of Zimbabwe Trick.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually an interesting discussion we could probably talk about for a while on if you'd consider proxy decks and print and plays and things like that as, you know, part of your collection and something that's taking up unplayed shelf space. Without going too far down that, I think it does. So the fact that, you know, you're calling that, you're removing unplayed games from your shelf, opening up, you know, more games to play again or other games that you'd think you'd have a more likelihood of playing.
It's always a difficult one with proxy games because some of the games obviously require a standard deck of cards. Some of the games you need to actively get proxy components for. And sometimes that can include a board or just a rule set. So where do you draw the line? Because this is interesting, Ryan. You are right. What level of proxying would you have to go to class the game as a game that you own, if we're going there, and more specifically, perhaps a game that you mark as owned on BoardGameGeek?
Yeah, and it's funny you actually mentioned that too, because there was a massive chain on a BGG forum within the Trick-Taking Guild a few weeks ago on this about if you bought a deck of cards and you Sharpied on some Jokers and you made them the special cards to match Tichu, would you actually be playing Tichu? Would you actually be owning Tichu and things like that? Yeah. And there was one side was more heavily towards, I forget, you know, I wasn't prepared to talk about that. So I want to pull up those questions. So give me one second, actually.
See if I'm intrigued.
Yeah, we're going to take a little side detour here. Okay, so on the Trick-Taking Guild, the three questions that were posted were, did my friends and I just play Tichu? Would you recognize that this was a different gaming experience than playing with a published Tichu deck? And is my new creation, the standard deck that I wrote on, a copy of Tichu?
Very philosophical.
Yeah, and that's actually what the main title was Board Game Philosophy Poll.
There we go. It's like I knew about this Fred and I didn't know about the Fred. That's strange.
So 97% of people said, yes, we just played Tichu, to answer the first question. The second question was 55% to 44% of saying, would you recognize that it was a different experience than using a published deck? Okay. And the third question was 53% to 46% on, is my new creation a copy of Tichu? 53% said no, 46% said yes. And then this then led to pages of people responding and coming up with different theories and different ways of why yes was correct or why no was correct. And that day, I just remember on other servers as well on Discord within like the traditional gaming server, a couple others, you know, the Portland Game Collective server, people were talking about this and trying to come up with what the answer was to that. So I just think it's funny that we're mentioning
it is
the print and plays and the proxies. And do you consider them a part of your collection?
It's funny because there's almost another topic closely related to this conversation. And that is it right to proxy a game if the game's retail version is also available? And that might feed into the reason why some people hesitate to mark the game as owned. Perhaps they feel like, I don't have the official copy, so therefore I can't say that I own it. And maybe that part of that is, what will other people think if I do? There is that mindset. In my case, I've got a lot of noise in my collection. I'm sure you have, Ryan, and that's part of the reason for the challenges. And I hesitate because I hate to see that number go up on Board Game Geek, where it's games that you own. And I have to ask myself, do I really own that game? What's your stance on it? Do you mark them as owned, or are you on the fence?
I, for simplicity's sake, marked it as owned. Only because when it comes to print and plays and proxies like that, you know, there's a few good standards you can use. There's the Hecka deck, there's the Badger deck. Then, of course, there's a regular playing card deck you could Sharpie and whatnot. Or using another game that can match, you know, Great Dom Moody can use for Zimbabwe Trick. So it's nice to see on an app all of the things that I own, quote unquote own, even if I have a print and play of it. Because if I look on my shelf and I just see the Great Dom Moody, I'm not going to see Zimbabwe Trick unless I remember, oh yeah, hey, that was a proxy for that as well. You know, for some of mine, I actually do put, like, I print out a piece of paper. So like Voodoo Prints, on the box itself, I printed out a piece of paper that also said Cauldron 15 on it. So I know that this is going to be proxy, then I can use it for that game. I don't do that for all of them, but I still mark the game as owned on BGG, so, or on the BG Stats app, so that when I look through, I can just see on the app a quick scroll what I do have.
See, the thing is, what you can do is you can, what I've started to do is put P&P in the version section, because you can put other versions of the game. And I've created a tag. There's an app, you probably use it. In fact, I know you use it. BG Stats allows you to create tags. So I've tagged all my print and plays so I can find them easily. And perhaps I put a favorite play account, best at four, best at three. And you can still find them that way. They still get added to the app, whether or not you decide to mark them as owned.
Yeah. And I think for me, why I'm more lenient on it is because the stats and tracking all that is for me and me only.
Okay.
Like, if somebody goes onto my BGG profile and sees that I own Cauldron 15 when I really only have a print and play, and they're upset by that or confused by that, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. That's on them. Like, it's for me to know what I have available to play, whether it's the official copy or print and play. So just like you tagging the best at player counts, like, that's for you to be able to check your own stats to see, okay, I want to look through all my trick-taking games, which ones play best at four. That's for you to look at and not anybody else. I mean, it could be helpful for other people, but you designed it for you and you alone.
So before I go into the is it right or wrong, in my case, how I come to that decision, I say to myself, I haven't got these three philosophical questions, which are great, by the way. I think it's quite detailed, and that gives you something to think about. Alongside the meaning of life, you know, when you wake up with your morning cup of coffee, you can think about those questions. I always say to myself, what components have I gathered for this game? Is it more than a set of rules? Is it more than a standard set of cards? And is it more than just printing off a board off the computer? For instance, if I had to get counters, if I had to get cubes, perhaps I created a board for Le Plateau and I carved around it with a knife and really tried to get it into a detailed work of art, which they look great. That's how I reached the decision for me. So with games like Bacon, which is essentially a few standard decks of cards, I hesitated and thought, well, I've only printed three player aids out. Surely it can't be an own game. It's difficult.
The thing is, I will say, I mean, yeah, there's really no right or wrong answer, I think, in this situation. It's always going to come down to your own personal preference and opinion and on how you view, you know, consumerism and capitalism and things like that, because having a standard deck of cards can get you to play a lot of games. And theoretically, a standard deck of cards could also be print and played. You could just take a sheet of paper and Sharpie Ace of Spades, Two of Spades, three, you know, do the whole entire 52 cards, and you've got a deck of cards with a sheet of paper. So, you know, where does that cycle end? And I've even heard, you know, a lot of people say that when they are designing some of these games, they're trying to design them with the fact that it can be with, played with a regular deck of cards in mind, so that the ability to proxy it or play it, you know, try it out before you buy the actual version.
So that's where we'll go then, because as you know, for me, part of the reason why I'm reluctant is because I'm doing this challenge, this can't buy more than 12 games, can't acquire more than 12 games in the year. And I think, well, if I mark it as owned, I'm technically acquiring that game. So I'm treading on eggshells as I contemplate, really, have I just bought this game? You know, sorry, not bought. Have I just added this to my collection? Yeah, that's a big thing.
I think that's the distinction. The word you just used where you said bought and you corrected yourself, it comes down to what I said on a couple episodes ago, where it's you're adding a new unplayed game to your list. So is the 12 game limit, are you trying to limit yourself because of money reasons and you don't want to buy more games? Or are you trying to limit your time and making sure that you're only buying an appropriate amount of games that you know you can then play within that, you know, 1 year time period that you're giving yourself to buy? Not saying that there is one way right or the other, but that's where I'm getting at. And I guess that's kind of my question to you. Have you sort of decided on which approach you are going with these?
Combination of financial, but the main reason is to try and have a healthier relationship with the hobby, to try and recognize that last year I went absolutely bonkers and bought way too many games. But the main reason, above all else, is to reduce the noise, reduce that background noise, that looking at the shelf, there's a world of opportunities, and that's great. But the people who I play with, we put our collections together and we always say, this game would be great if only we didn't have so many other games to demand the table time and really explore it and come back to it and play it often. So unfortunately, you know, we might not revisit this game for another 12 months. And that's my main motivation. It's that noise, that background noise. And I actually feel relieved at culling some of these games. How about you?
No, I feel great about a lot of the ones that I've gotten rid of as well. A handful of them are always ones that I've been holding on to, just thinking, oh, well, the theme is cool enough. This one person, when they do come over, might like it. Or when, you know, the good old fashioned, well, at this player count, this game works best. And, you know, five is a weird player count, so we'll keep that one for this. But even though there's six others that I have, they're also at five players. And I was noticing with a handful of these games that when they're getting played or when they're being discussed, there was always a comparison with another game. We've done it on this show a handful of times. Like, yes, American Bookshop is a good example.
It feels just like that. You've also got that game, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so playing American Bookshop and saying, oh, this is kind of like Cauldron 15. Cauldron 15 does this, Cauldron 15 does that. It's like, well, I keep mentioning Cauldron 15 so many times. Why aren't I just playing Cauldron 15? Why do I still need to have American Bookshop? And that's how I feel a lot with a bunch of these. Tricky Time Crisis, like Potato Man and David and Goliath are leaving my collection pretty soon because I will pretty much always play Tricky Time Crisis now. I don't
Ryan,
see
not
myself.
Potato Man. What's Potato Man done wrong? What's the evidence of you?
He doesn't have good scoring like Tricky Time Crisis.
Too many carbs in the collection.
Yeah.
Something like that. I agree. And I think it's, as we've established, getting rid of that noise and streamlining. I've got food on the mind. We talked about potatoes. Streamlining your collection to try and... There's a lot of duplicates. And genres, Euro games, for example, there's a lot of games that do similar things. So at what point are you saturated with trick takers that are all similar, have too many commonalities? It's a tough call, but it's personal.
The big thing too, there, you know, it's a double-edged sword with trick-taking games. We always say, oh, these are great because you can learn them in 5-10 minutes. You can play them in 25 to 45 minutes. You can get, you know, 3, 4, 5 games in a game night. Whereas if you're playing a Euro, you're probably only playing that one game. Well, it's like, do you really need to be playing 4 or 5 okay or mediocre trick takers when you know you've already got 5 to 10 others that are really good that do something like it? And it's, you know, I'm still trying to compare within just the trick taking universe of all the card games. So it's still okay to play 4 or 5 trick takers in a night. I'm not saying don't do that. Older traditional style games are designed to be like a, oh, you were only playing this one trick taking game all night. Like if you're playing Doppelkopf, you're playing 32 hands for 3-4 hours. If you're playing bridge or, you know, I mean, sometimes people for spades, things like that. Like those are one and done for the night. But modern trick taking has definitely moved towards the, as people like to try and call it, a filler game. Even though it, I don't really see them as filler games, but that's, you know, we're a little bit heavier and deeper into the trick taking hobby. Yeah. So we use them as
a little bit.
Yeah. As full games, or we try to make it that way. But they're still, in an overall board game sense, very much still in the filler scene for a lot of people. And I think that's where that difference comes in.
It's recognizing that we've certainly followed Alice into the rabbit hole as far as trick-taking goes. But even we can take a step back and realize there's so many excellent games out there, and there's so many games that are just good or just average. So I would like to try and strive for excellence in my collection. And I think if I can achieve that and have this streamlined collection of games, that's fantastic. With proxying games, that's obviously a great way to try them. We've been talking about proxying and not marking them as owned, etc. Great way to try games. Some games you just can't get, so we always talk about, oh, well, try it out on PCIO or make your own version. And the question I wanted to ask you then, Ryan, when is it right or wrong? Is there might not be a correct answer to this, to proxy a game, because there's always going to be people out there who say you should be buying the copy, you should be supporting the publisher, and anything that is a proxy is wrong. That's on the extreme side, and some people think that, and that's fine. Where do you land with it?
I don't know if I should answer this on a recorded line, but no, not that I have a bad answer. Again, I'm agreeing with you, though. I don't think there is a true right or wrong answer. It ultimately comes down to personal opinion on how you treat consumerism and capitalism, mm-hmm. in the sense of, if you don't buy the official game and support the publisher, artist, and designer, then you don't have a true copy of the game. And I mean, obviously, you know, I get that. As someone who is part of a publishing company, I totally get that. If we are creating games and putting them out there, I'd obviously like if somebody bought the official copy that we spent all that time and hard work in creating and bringing it out into the world. But sometimes it's not possible or feasible for everybody. Everyone has a completely different living situation. Where you live in the world can also be a big factor. Especially for small publishers, shipping a game out to, you know, the middle of New Zealand is going to be 3 times the cost of the game itself. And it's hard for a small publisher to be like, oh, well, we'll eat some of that cost. And then it ends up being, well, I can't buy the game, and then I'll just find a way to proxy it instead. To me, personally, if you are at least still playing the game in any form, you are supporting the people who came up with the idea of the game. And you might not be directly giving the publisher, designer, and artist the money for buying it, but if it's a game that you are enjoying and liking, and you are sharing it with friends and family, whether it's just in person or on social media, yeah, you're going to get the game out there with other people who might be in the market to actually buy the game.
And I realized I put you in a really difficult spot with that question, because it was one of those where you could answer that in a way that would... The answer you gave, I think, is bang on, to be honest. And I think you made it some good points. So these games justify trying them. And if you do like them and you find a copy in the future because you can afford it, great. And if not, you know, leaving the designer a nice review on BGG because you really enjoy the game is great too. So I don't feel guilty about my dismantle proxy of Zimbabwe trick. It was impossible to find anyway, and now it's impossible to play. So haven't helped myself there. But anyway, what about our crossovers then? What about games that we both decided to get rid of?
Yeah, the first one on your list was Amino Kira Fuda. I know we've talked about that in the past a handful of times and how we keep trying to get it played, but it's still just pretty average, and we've both now sold it.
That's interesting, because it was only a few episodes back where I was saying, you know, Amino Kira Fuda, somebody out there, please like it. And I think we probably both reached a point where people just aren't that bothered about, certainly with our gaming groups, the game. And when you've got options like Cat in the Box or Trick Takers with a greater sense of control, at least, then it probably makes sense. Lovely production. The girl with the sword on the front was great. The stones were great. The cards were lovely. The concept was the seasons, beautiful. When you told me about this game, I was hook, line, and sinker sold on it. But the execution kind of fell off a cliff, didn't it? And that's the thing.
Yeah. I think that's where we both kind of come to the point of knowing that that game just kind of hit the line. And it's like you just said earlier, we're just spoiled for choice. We have so many other games out there. If this game came out 15 years ago, it would blow your mind. This would probably be like a top 10 trick taker for me, at least.
At least just, seasonal, right?
Yeah, at least seasonal. The fact that it just does some of the things pretty well, but it just falls short on them being perfect and being better than the other games that we already have in our collections, at least for me, is one of the reasons why I got rid of it.
Yeah. Agree. It's enough to stoke curiosity. If you want to try something different, it's okay. It's a good time. But for our reasons, I think we made the right decision on that one. What about the next one?
I think it was Loser's Rights.
Yeah, unfortunately, Loser's Rights has officially lost out in our collections, at least. What do you think about Loser's Rights then? Because this game was hot out the oven at one point, and I spoke to the designer, very nice person. They were inspired by Stick'em, so there was a May Follow variant for it. The illustrations on the cards are great. I played this and we had a good time. So why for you then did it lose out? I'm going to be playing on the word losers, just a word of warning.
I am going to ignore every time you play on that word.
You knew it was coming. You've got the right to do that.
Yes, I do. And I guess I'll be kind of honest. I just don't remember much from it. I've played it twice in total. The first time was at PGCCon, which I mentioned before. And one of the players in our group of four just had a really bad experience. Won every trick, got no points, had nothing they could do. And if anybody knows with the calendars and it being May of 2023 and PGCCon was July of 2022, it's been almost a year since I've played the game. So I really don't remember much. And it's been sitting on my shelf since then, unplayed. So it just needed to be moved on.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because I played it once and it was okay. And they were like, yeah, that was all right. But the key thing for me is nobody brought it up. Nobody mentioned it again. It was just consigned to the realms of, oh, we've played it, and oh, it was a trick-taking game. It's not good enough, is it? Well, not for me in my collection now, based on where I'm at with too many trick-takers. I'm not saying it's a bad game. You had a bad experience with somebody you played with. And some people will love this, but I feel having less trick takers might make me appreciate it more. Some things are going to lose out. You knew it was coming.
Of course I did. I was prepared for it. but I still didn't like it.
The houses, though, the cards, right? That's great. The artwork.
Yeah, no, the artwork's nice. The idea of the area control aspect and how it theoretically plays out on, you know, putting it on the corners or the center or the sides determines how much majority it gives you. It's like a lot of these games, the hooks they give you have to be really short. I mean, the game itself is pretty short. So a trick-taking game, you can get the hook a little bit faster because there's that, you know, must follow, may follow, trump, no trump thing that you can just toss in really quickly. And players who've played a trick-taking game before already know what you mean.
Right.
It's like standard when you say, hey, this is game. It's like if you say, this is a worker placement game, okay, you've got the general idea of how it's going to flow, where's that hook? And with this game, adding in that area control hook and how it works, you're like, okay, that's cool. But then, you know, once you play it, it's just fine.
It's just fine. There we go. There's the flavor of the day here, really, isn't it? And you'll know with Ryan whether it goes beyond or transcends beyond just fine, because he might then give it his interesting award, or he'll use the word interesting a few times when he's describing it. So that should tell you all you need to know for Loser's Rights from our perspective.
You're correct.
There we go. I always caveat our perspective here because there's going to be some fans and that's cool.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing is, like, all the time whenever we talk about these games, it's always like, I know we might not like them. And there's even games that I don't like that you like, and there's ones that you like that I don't like. That's going to obviously be the case all the time. But I always kind of hope that whenever we do discuss some of these games on here, we'll hear from someone who has had a good experience with it.
Yes, the group is everything. Off topic just a second, but Brass Birmingham, for instance, phenomenal game. Excellent game, but it's only me and my partner that can play it, because the other group that I would take it to wouldn't have time for it. And that transitions into trick taking, of course, and that is also part of the problem, I imagine.
No, absolutely. In trick taking in particular, you can boil it down to even just something as simple as must follow, may follow. It's a drastic difference in a style of gameplay on how trick-taking works. There are some people that I've played with that just don't like may follow because of how open and free the card play is on, oh, you can play literally anything you want.
Yeah.
Which is funny. I mean, you know, because there's that then complaint of in a must-follow game, there's not enough choices and it's too constrained and it all just feels random.
Yeah, not enough choices.
So, you know, who knows? That's absolutely a factor that can happen in just bidding games. I know bidding games obviously can be very divisive.
Yes, they can. Yeah, and that's gone into our thought process without a doubt when we've considered some of these games that we're culling. I was going to say a game, Ryan, that we didn't have a crossover for, so that game probably shouldn't make the crossover comparison list, should it?
Probably not. I think you should. I think you're going to say Washtick. And that is definitely not a crossover. I have not played that, have no interest in playing it. It's not that, again, that's just my personal opinion. I'd rather play Pompiers or The Crew. So anyways, moving on.
Moving on. So Ryan, you call it Salvage and I call it St. Patrick. Even though it's another Patrick, what am I doing with my life, right? It's another Patrick that I'm moving on. But it's essentially the same game, of course. There was St. Patrick, the newer version, Salvage, the original version. And what's the thought process behind it for you, then, getting rid of Salvage? Can't salvage it in the collection?
I have five words for this game.
Okay.
I would rather play Hearts.
Ouch.
I had to count before I said this to make sure it was five words.
You'll make an actuarial of you yet. That's great.
I mean, to distill Salvage and St. Patrick, it's essentially Hearts with a twist. And okay. The twist in the game for myself and my two different groups that I've played this game with has fallen really flat. There's just a runaway leader problem with in Salvage, it's the oil tokens. And St. Patrick, it's the like protective
the
bite or something.
Snake cure things. Tokens. The tokens, right?
The tokens that you collect. The very first part of the phase of the round where it allows you to protect yourself from the negative points you'd be taking in card play. The thing is, though, if all of the tokens are taken from the pile, then all players lose 1 point for all tokens they've taken. And the problem is, once you lose any amount of points in a round, you're already now at a point deficit. You are losing. So you have to be more careful on the number of tokens you take, because if you take too many, then the other players can just clear out the board, and then you're going to keep losing points and get to zero before they will. But the problem is, those tokens protect you from losing points during the round. So if you take less amount of tokens, then you're more likely going to lose points during trick play.
Right. And that's, and I will confess that actually Ryan told me he was going to get rid of this game about 5 minutes prior to recording this episode. And I then said, based on that then, Ryan, unfortunately, your sales pitch was too good for culling it. I'm going to have to cull it too, because I really like Hearts as a classic game, a classic trick avoidance game. I already knew, I already had suspicions about Salvage, but I think you, or St. Patrick in my case, but you kind of put the nail in its coffin. I made a scoreboard for it because it didn't come with one. I went to that effort. I sleeved the cards and thought, it's got my name in it. It's got to be good. It needs to get played. And now I'm not even bothered if I don't play it. But if I had half as much trick takers, then I would probably hang on to it. So I think, you know, this is from a saturation perspective rather than the game is bad for me.
Yeah, I think so as well. I mean, again, if I had never played Hearts before and that was my first introduction to that style of game, I maybe would give the, I don't know, because I still have the problem with the initial runaway leader problem with that token part. But I don't know, maybe I'd be a little more forgiving with it. I'm not sure.
Okay. And next up, R Echo. Now, that's a joke. I'm not really getting rid of that game. I talk about it a lot on this show, so we'll park that.
I feel like that would be sacrilegious if you get rid of that game at this point.
No, I'd have to get rid of it and then get it back into my collection, so it's like a recycling theme, right? That's... Anyway, moving on, yeah?
Yes, moving on.
Still with the snakes, though. Cobras, which St. Patrick has the snakes in. Cobras is obviously speaks for itself. I didn't play this game. I had the game, apparently very devilishly difficult to find the game because it's out of print. I got it for a good price. It sat on my shelf in its basket. The snakes sit in baskets, the cobras, right? So it's kind of just sat there and sat there. And I had no motivation whatsoever to pull the game out and play it, because relative to all the other stuff that's coming out in my collection. How did you get on with it? Because I remember you saying, Ryan, that you were going to try it, and I hung on to mine for a little bit, thinking, oh, it's all right, Ryan's going to do me a nice report soon, and in the end, I just gave up.
Yeah, I have only officially played it once. I multi-handed it a handful of times, because I've owned this game for months now. And every time I multi-handed, I'm just like, oh, this might be okay once we finally get it to the table. But I've never been like itching to get it played, and I always just let it pass by. But now that I've created this unplayed challenge, I'm like, all right, this is one of the ones I'm going to get played. When I went to relearn the rules, make sure everything down, and I did the multi-hand, we were going to have five players that night. And I never multi-handed it to the five players. I only ever did it at three and four. And when I finally got through the five players, I realized, oh, no, this is not going to be anywhere nearly as enjoyable at the lower player counts.
It had no bite.
Had no bite. Lost all its venom.
There we go.
And the... I ended up playing it at three players once it finally happened. That night when we had five players, I nixed it. I was like, no, it's going to stay on the unplayed shelf for a little bit longer. Finally got it played at three players. And it was just fine.
Just fine.
The hook on paper, the idea of trying to take the right number of cobras. Quick pitch on cobras. There's scoring where on the number cards themselves, they're cobras that range from 1 to 3. If you lose the trick, you're going to gain cobras from these little cobra tokens. and you're going to put them on the little scorecard in front of you. When you win a trick, you spend all of your Cobra tokens, and the number of tokens that you spend will be how many points you score. You're trying to get 7 Cobra tokens. That's like the best you can do. If you have 0 or 1, you're going to get a low number of points. And then if you have, you know, above 7, the more you go, you're going to start losing points as well. So it's sort of a bell curve trying to hit right in the middle. But there's a problem of where it just comes down to the point of if you have the high cards in a suit, it was easy to just play low, and then come in and win, and then get it at the right time. And in a 3-player game, because everybody wants to get at 7 Cobras, we were basically just taking turns on who was doing it. Because if one person's winning a trick, 2 other people are losing, and they're gaining a number of Cobras, which means those 2 players are probably getting close to 7. So now one of them probably wants to win, but the person who just won doesn't want to win again because now they have 0 Cobras. You must always spend all of your Cobras when you win. So that person's usually leading with a low number. So the next 2 players are going to more than likely win. Whichever one of those 2 doesn't win, then that next person like wants to win. So it's a weird cycle that the game was having. And like the scoring threshold was really high. So we could tell the game was going to play for a very long time, which it did. So yeah.
So Cobras, I mean, I just remember reading about this King Cobra card. And I remember people saying, yeah, it's all right, but the King Cobra card kind of skews the... It's kind of necessary, but at the same time, it's too powerful. And I'm not going to be swayed completely by what people say on BGG or elsewhere. I have to make my own decision. But just a general lack of excitement to play it. That's my problem. And you, again, you haven't really sold me on it to want to go and get it back to play it.
There's no snake charmer here.
No snake charmer here. There we go. I'm on the fence about American Bookshop, Ryan. I have Cauldron 15, and I obviously have American Bookshop. We'll probably talk in a little more detail in the future about Cauldron 15's new free player threshold. There's a new threshold for 12 points instead of 15, and a little new card that comes with it. So I tried that out. But I'm kind of thinking, like you, well, 2 similar games, do I keep one and get rid of the other? So I just need a bit more time to work out whether American Bookshop still has a place on my bookshelf and go from there.
No, it's fair. I mean, I have, of course, reached that point myself.
Yeah.
So American Bookshop did go and has been sold on my last call, as we are talking about here. But I won't be surprised if you reach that point as well and end up selling off American Bookshop and keeping Cauldron 15. Because I believe you like Cauldron 15 more than American Bookshop, like me.
So the book case is really charming for American Bookshop. We won't talk about how I have to keep it closed with bondage tape because I've sleeved all the cards and it just opens by itself. Right. The Cauldron 15 art is also really charming. As we know, really cute. And they've obviously they're re-releasing for Tokyo Games Market. So that's now become very accessible. The reason I'm still hesitating is because I played it recently at 3 players and one of the players wasn't sure on it. We got a rule wrong. We didn't score. We scored to 12 instead of 15, which we should have done based on the 3 player rules. So I'm going to try him out with American Bookshop. Hopefully I don't do a 360 and say, oh, well, I got rid of Cauldron 15, because that's the one that I would always want to play over American Bookshop myself. But as we always say, group dependency. So we'll see.
Yeah, and hopefully the person you show American Bookshop to actually likes it more, and then you can sell your copy of American Bookshop to them.
Well, there you go. There's the other option. But of course, he'll use the excuse, I'm the one with all the games. I'm the one with all the trick takers. So he'll just come round to mine, pour himself a beer, and then wait for the next game to arrive on the table. I don't know if you get that as well, but are you the main buyer in your group of the games, Ryan?
Oh, absolutely. If there's anyone who's actually buying a trick taker, it's because they've played a copy of it with me and I was doing an import order, so it just got tossed in as well. I'd say 90% of the things that I have in my collection, nobody else in the area has.
Well, there you go. Partly, I imagine, because they're so hard to come by unless you know where to look. The Japanese ones specifically, but there we go.
Totally.
So you've mentioned to me, Ryan, you're considering moving on another couple of games that you haven't called this time. And those games, one of those games is Ghosts of Christmas, which I have also just called. You have, or we have spoke about it briefly on previous episodes. We've covered it, Ghosts of Christmas. So just briefly then, what made you decide now was the time that you're thinking about getting rid of it? I know it wasn't in your recent calls.
Too many games.
TooManyGames.com.
Yeah, I mean, I have Monster Trick as well. Does similar-ish enough thing. As we've discussed in the Ghost of Christmas episode, the scoring in Ghost of Christmas can be very harsh and unforgiving.
Yeah.
The last few games I've played, we've had runaway leader problem, and it sort of soured the other two players at the table, their experience of playing it. For me, that doesn't really ever bother me that much. As I've stated many times on the show, I don't care about winning or losing at all. I just want to have a good time and enjoy myself and the company that's with me. But if the company does care about winning or losing and aren't enjoying the gameplay because of something like that, then it's also going to bring down my enjoyment as well. And that means it's not going to come out to the table again. And this is one that I haven't seen myself playing in quite some time. And I just don't see it making a list of getting played again anytime soon.
Right. All Play did a great job on the production, the, you know, the wooden hat, the Reeves, the theme is so unique. Not many games do the Christmas theme. But beyond that, we know Taiki Shinzawa is a very clever person. He's obviously a genius designer. And we always say sometimes the concept can be sound better than the execution. And certainly I found that with Ghosts of Christmas, I immediately went to the Tiny Tim variant. We'll forget about the, you know, the harsh scoring of the classic game for my group. And it was just fine. A likable game, a charming game. But I also, like yourself, own Monster Trick. I think Monster Trick is brilliant. So it's just having two things that do the same thing. Not that it's a crime, but for that reason, I don't have two kettles in my kitchen and two coffee makers, if you want to put it bluntly. I'm sure there's loads of crossovers on my shelves if we boil it down to the actual DNA of the game. But it's another victim of too many games.
For certain. Yeah, and I'd say the other game that I am likely to move on as well is Shamans. And that also falls prey to being very similar to Inside Job, which I absolutely adore Inside Job. Whenever we're considering playing a social deduction type trick-taking game now, which there clearly aren't that many of, it just always comes down to Inside Job at this point. I and the table always seem to have a more enjoyable time. There's more laughs involved, even though there's still the stressful moments of people trying to yell at each other of you're the bad guy, you're the bad guy. There still ends up being more laughs, whereas in Shamans it just comes down to a shouting match. The may follow aspect, the second one player doesn't follow, it's like it just breaks down from there.
Oh, you're the, you know, the bad guy, right? You've not followed. It's obvious, right? That I it's the way mechanics work.
Yeah, it's like the Resistance or the Resistance to Avalon, whichever version you play, where there's no real, like when you go on missions, you don't actually go on any mission. It's just you hand a token to a player and you hope that they're on the team. If you're on the bad guy team, if you're on your good guy team, they're on your team. And it just becomes a shouting match of, why'd you give it to that person? They're not on the right team. They're on the other team. Why would you do that? And there's no real, like, I mean, sure, you could metagame and in strategy and whatnot, but it's really just a shouting match of how well you can bluff or how well you can convince someone. And while I don't want to say Inside Job doesn't also have that problem from time to time, I think it has that problem a little bit less than Shamans does.
Right. And I think I haven't played Shamans, and I'll caveat, but for me, the Mayfollow concept is interesting. I don't like the sound of the, oh, you know, someone could come along and stab you with a ritual dagger and then you're done for. I have some concerns from reading about the balance of the two sides, although I can't speak to that with my group because obviously haven't played it. I did read the rules a few times, watch a few teaches, and for me, it sounded a bit more fiddly than I'd like it to be with, you know, as the mask this, and if you may follow, and then somebody else can claim that. It just seemed a bit more clunky, more steps involved, whereas Inside Job, which I have played, is pretty much straight down to the fun, right?
Yeah, it's a bit more streamlined, I would think.
Yeah.
The like abilities that you can get with Shamans and the tokens that you can grab, you said the daggers and the revealing and the swapping of cards.
Masks,
you can
just, and,
yeah, you can be on the good guy team, and then all of a sudden, the last turn of the game, you can switch to the bad guy team and then win. And the person who's been doing all the hard work on the bad guy team loses now. Like, I know that some people have problems with that too. Yeah, it certainly adds to the fiddliness of the game, whereas Shamans or Inside Job is a little bit more straightforward. As you said, get straight to the fun. It's a must-follow standard trick-taking game with a mission that you're trying to complete every trick.
Yeah, less Resistance-esque. Not that Resistance was actually a game that I did call recently. Not a trick taker, of course. But
So you still own Resistance, is what you're telling me?
I got rid of that.
Oh, you got rid of it in the recent call.
Yeah. Because,
not that Riot, was a bad thing. I wasn't saying that like, oh my God, you still have that game?
No. I tried to resist, but the reason I got rid of it, just off topic slightly, but the reason I got rid of it was because trying to get 6, 7, 8 people together is difficult. And that's one of the nice things about trick takers, because a lot of them, 4 or 5 player, absolutely sweet. But trying to explain to somebody that, right, we're going to be going on missions, but then we're not actually going on a mission, I just thought it's hilarious. Well, that just blows some people's minds, right? So as a side note, the Resistance went, as a caveat, my group is not that huge, and it's just impossible to get it played.
It's funny, actually, the handful of times I've had somebody ask that when I say we're going on missions, and people like eyes light up a little bit, like, "Ooh, what mission are we doing? Like,
well, yeah,
where are we going?" Like, no, you're actually not doing anything. You're just saying you are. Who are you bringing with you is all you care about.
Yeah, we're just talking and we're pretending we're going on a mission, and you've told me I am, so I must be. Yeah, okay, well, hopefully that's given you an insight into the reasons why we're choosing to get rid of some of these games. As we always say, our perspective, our groups, too many games between us, certainly too many trick-taking games between me and Ryan, and we'd never want to be in a position where people think we're all, you know, downhearted about trick-taking games, or we've lost enthusiasm for them, because totally not the case. We love them to bits, but we can't keep them all. And hopefully, like Ryan said earlier, there's somebody who will reach out and say, hey, you know, I've had a lot of success with this game, my group. We've really enjoyed it, even though it's one of the ones that we're getting rid of.
And if I could have a library and I had room to keep all of these, I probably would. It's one of the main reasons why I kept them for so long, having that grandiose idea and plan of, I'll have a little mini convention myself. I'll have like 400 or 500 games. People have all the things to pick from, but it's just at this point, being a little bit more realistic, that's probably not going to happen. And there's so many of the ones that have been sitting that are average to our group or similar enough to others that I just don't need them anymore.
Yeah, I always like the idea, Ryan, of you've got a big Victorian key going into this secret library full of games. But really, when I think about it, all those rule sets swimming around in your head, oh, this is the game where you just can't store that much information. We're not computers. I mean, that philosophical debate, right? But we've not got a hard drive. So it's just so difficult.
How many cards do you deal out in this game?
Yeah.
First card win or later card win in the trick? Is there trump? Is there no trump? Is it must trump? Yeah. Lots to keep track of.
Yeah. And even that's within the realm of trick takers, of course. You expand that out in the hobby, and the cognitive burden is huge. So be interesting to see where we're at this time next year. Hopefully that's given you a good taster of our recent calls, and we're sure to be talking about some other trick taking games that we love soon. I believe that's all for now. Thank you for listening, and if you've got any questions or any comments, please let us know. Like we say, we're always here ready to listen. We have launched a Patreon page.
We haven't launched. We need to update that. You keep reading it and say we launched. We haven't launched. This bad boy has been launched for a while.
This bad boy's been launched, right? We have got a Patreon page.
We've updated the Patreon page, which even that has been a little while now.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There we go. I shouldn't read verbatim off documentation.
The only thing that we have scripted in the entire show is the last basically outro bit. And you always read it word for word, which is not a problem. Like, that's why we have it there. But we haven't updated the fact that we've launched the page since we've launched it, and we should probably do that.
Right. So, just as a side note, we have recently updated our Patreon page with some new pledge levels. We'll be doing more for people who are prepared to support the show. So, if you would like to financially support us, we'd really appreciate it. Of course, if all you can do is listen, that's great too. I know Ryan would like to talk a little bit more about something which we've also launched alongside called Linktree.
Yes, we now have a Linktree page, which houses all of the things that we say in our outro individually. Instead of having to go to them individually, if you want to just go straight to our Linktree, you can find them all housed in there. That includes the podcast itself, but also our Discord server that we have, that's also pretty recent, probably a month or so at this point, the Twitter and email and our merch store. We do have a merch store. I don't know if we've actually mentioned that on the show yet. I don't know if
Ryan is wearing a lovely Trick Talkers long sleeve top at the moment. Looks great on you, Ryan, I must say. So the pinnacle of modern fashion, clearly.
And I'm excited for my baby blue swim trunks that are coming. We'll see how those turn out.
They sound very exotic. Baby blue swim trunks. Where'd you go from there? Dive in to the sea of...
You're struggling with one here.
support for Trick Talkers. That was such an awkward way to summarize the blue trunks, but we got there, I think.
We did. Well, that is probably the longest outro we've had. I love it, as always. Keeping it awkward.
That's the best way. Thank you so much for listening.
See you around.
See you around.